Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, why translate fiction? We hear from two award-winning Bay Area authors who have a deep appreciation for world literature and who have been inspired, informed, or influenced by literature translated from other languages into English, and whose work has been translated from English for audiences abroad. Among other recognitions, they both have Lambda Literary Awards for LGBT fiction to their credit, and both are among seven highly regarded writers featured at Voices Carry, a celebration of international literature presented by the Center for the Art of Translation at the City Club of San Francisco, April 20th. Let me first introduce Sylvia Brownrigg. She's the author of five novels, a collection of short stories, and numerous published essays. Her work has been on the New York Times Notable Books list and the Los Angeles Times Best Books of the Year. She's won the Northern California Book Award and, for her novel Pages for You, a National Lambda Literary Award in the lesbian romance category. It has been translated into German and French. Last year, Penguin published her, is it first novel for children?
Yes.
Thank you. Kepler's Dream, written under the pen name Juliet Bell. The paperback will be published next month, May 2013. She's currently working on a new novel for adults and another for kids. Sylvia Brownrigg, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
K.M. Soenlein is the author of three novels, including The World of Normal Boys, which received a Lambda Literary Award for gay fiction and which has also been translated internationally. His shorter writings have appeared in The Village Voice, San Francisco Magazine, 7x7, Out, and other publications and anthologies. He teaches in the Master of Fine Arts and Writing program at the University of San Francisco and is almost finished with a new novel, Everybody, Everybody, about New York AIDS activism in the 1980s. He was on Out in the Bay in 2010, just after the publication of Robin and Ruby, a sequel to The World of Normal Boys. K.M. Soenlein, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be back, Eric.
Also with us is Brent Sverdlov, Executive Director of the Center for the Art of Translation, which presents the Voices Carry event at which Sylvia and K.M. are appearing. He'll fill us in on the details, and I'm sure we'll add to the conversation about world literature. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you, Eric.
So, Sylvia and K.M., to start us off, if you would please give us some brief comments or insights on how reading literature translated from other languages has influenced or inspired you. Any particular works that leap to mind for either of you?
You know, I think reading literature from around the world is the same reason that you read literature from this country. You just want to know about the lives that people lead. And then, of course, when you're reading from another country, work that was written in another language, you're getting insight that you just don't get, every day, even if you're watching the news or reading the news. So for me, it's just a way to sort of visit the world without actually going anywhere.
Okay.
I would echo what Carl said. I consider, you know, all reading to be a bridge to other people and other experiences. And it was fun to think about what writer to read for this event on the 20th, because there were so many different writers who came to mind as people who I loved and who influenced me, both in my writing and just in my living, you know.
So who did you end up choosing for this event on the 20th?
Well, I chose Irène Nemirovsky, who is a French writer who wrote during the Second World War, but her work wasn't known broadly until the last decade, because her manuscript was buried. She was killed by the Nazis. Mm-hmm. So it's a very powerful story how that book came into the world. And it's a beautiful novel called Suite Française.
Okay, good. Hopefully we'll talk a little bit more later. Sylvia, your novel that won the Lambda Award, Pages for You, was about a young California woman, 17 years old, off to college on the East Coast, who meets and falls in love with a graduate student. And a big part of their courtship, is that the right word to use?
I think so.
Okay, is reading to each other, reading about other worlds. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Flannery, the 17-year-old, the young Californian in the story, is going off to college and has everything to discover the way one does at 17. And so she's discovering the East Coast as a Californian. She's discovering this great intellectual richness of this university life. And she's discovering what it is to have a body, to fall in love, and to become a romantic sexual
person. A young sexual being.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. it's all there together in this story. So.
And I haven't read the book, but I've read some of the critical, not reviews, but the little
reviews,
excerpts that you have on your website, and it's all nice and very juicy. But the one that really, I think,
that's why we put them on the website.
Of course. Well, like the realization that love can devastate just as easily as it exalts.
Yes.
But there's this one about the Entertainment Weekly calling your lack of fuss about the gender of the lovers refreshing.
Yes, it's interesting. It was interesting to write that novel. It's funny. I remember when I was in the process of writing it, a young editor at my publisher said, but Sylvia, what do you know about being 17? I was in my 30s at the time. I was like, well, I was 17, actually, believe it or not. So, but anyway, I think the thing about writing that story at a later time was that I could really focus on the sensual details and just the beauty of falling in love with someone, which is, I think, why it's a very powerful story for people who've had exactly that experience. And my hope, and I think what's happened, is that it speaks to people who've had different kinds of first passions also.
So tell us a little bit about this, you know, in a nutshell, and I know it's hard to do that, but, you know, kind of what this story is about.
It's really the story of her love for this woman, Anne. It's Flannery's love with Anne. It's what it is to meet somebody, to think you couldn't possibly be good enough to even speak to them, to have that feeling returned, to discover that passion. And then, I'm afraid, you know, the arc is the fulfillment, the excitement, and then the devastation, as mentioned.
I know, but part of it sounds like the description for it sounds like, oh, it's a spy thriller. She finds out things about Anne that she wish she didn't know.
Well, the way like that. That's a part of falling in love, too, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
it's
I thought
true.
You were perfect. You were supposed to be perfect.
Right. You were supposed to be perfect. So you have a short section of pages for you to read to us?
I do. As you say, the reading is a big part of the relation between these two women. They read, for them, reading and loving are very intertwined. And so this is a little exchange when they're still getting to know each other. They aren't involved yet. And Anne is her TA, or was her TA, for a class on criticism. And they're at a bar and experimenting with having a drink together. And Anne asks her what other classes she's taking besides criticism. And Flannery says, revolution, art history, world fiction. I was taking animal behavior, but had to drop it. And Anne says, that's an eclectic mix. Well, I'm undeclared. In my major, I mean. They both let that pass. So, world fiction. Who do you read in that? What is world fiction, anyway? Fiction from the world, I guess. As opposed to fiction from other worlds? Yeah, Flannery liked the joke. That's probably the kind I'll write. Ah, Anne took another sip of her drink, rummaged around in her pockets for her cigarettes. You're hoping to write? Not hoping to, exactly. Flannery looked puzzled. I just do. I think I'll leave it there.
So, how autobiographical is it?
Well, it's funny. I actually took little stories of my own life, and it's in some ways a collage of different relations I had in college. Because it is quite a vivid story of these two women, people often think I had literally this relation with somebody very like Anne, and I didn't. I actually wrote this novel as a kind of affectionate fiction for somebody else altogether. It was sort of a gift in that way. But it drew here and there, and then a lot of it was just from my own imagination.
And even though you wrote it more than a decade, you told me when we spoke on the phone earlier this week that you still get more comments on it than on your more recent books. And I'm curious to know why you think that is.
Yes, it's really, this novel touches a chord with people more than, I would say, just more intensely than other fictions. I think largely because it's a love story. I think because it's a love story between two women, that's always going to, I think that it speaks to particularly young women who are coming out. I think it does have that, it connects in that way with people. I think it also, I got a recent note from a parent of a young lesbian who said, you know, it was so great to read this story. It really helped me understand what my daughter, you know, the woman my daughter loves and why. And so I'm very happy and pleased to have written something that speaks to people in that way.
And still does and continues to after about 10, 12 years?
Yeah. It still really finds its readers, which just really makes me happy.
So, K.M. Sonline, I'm curious if your experience is similar. Do you still get a lot of feedback on your first novel, The World of Normal Boys, the one for which you won the Lambda in 2001?
I do. I'd say of the three novels I've published, that one seems to be the one I hear from readers about the most. And it might be very similar to what Sylvie's describing, which is that the kind of romantic story at the heart of it, I think, speaks to a lot of people. My book is about a young teenager. He's 13, 14 years old. There's a tragedy in his family. His brother is in an accident, and it sort of throws the house into an upheaval. And that's all happening at the same time that Robin, the boy, is starting to rebel, starting to smoke pot, starting to have sex with other boys. So he's a sort of precocious, adventurous young teenager, all of which gets escalated by the family tragedy. And I think that combination of coming out and dealing with a kind of messed up family has a universal aspect. You know, I think the other books have their own things that touch readers as well. But readers love reading about young people. It's like they love their younger self, and we all share something in common, you know, which is that sort of adolescent experience.
And I think it's also true. It seems like as gay people, we seem to always be swapping coming out stories like, oh, when did you first find out? I mean, maybe not so much now, but that certainly seemed true when I was younger.
I think it's still true. And I remember when I was trying to get this book published, which was 99, 2000. Can't believe it's that long ago already. It was my first novel, and it's always hard to get a first book published. And what my agent was hearing was, people don't want to hear coming out stories anymore. You know, we've heard them. They're all the same. And, you know, it turns out that that's not true, that we still actually do want to hear what it was like when you were uncertain and didn't know and had to hide and hadn't told anyone. That there's something very powerful about that closeted moment for people. Even now in our, you know, gay marriage out in the military era, I think it still holds a lot of power for people. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. My guests are authors Sylvia Brownrigg and Cam Sohnlein, along with five other Bay Area writers. They will be appearing at Voices Carry, a celebration of international literature hosted by the Center for the Art of Translation on April 20th, a week from this Saturday. April 20th. I just said that. I don't know why I wrote it in my copy twice. Brent Sverdlov is also with us. He's the executive director of the Center for the Art of Translation. Brent, what's the idea behind bringing seven novelists together to talk about translation? What can we expect from this evening?
Well, Eric, this is really a celebration of great literature, independently of language. Just as we've heard on the show from KM and Sylvia, language and gender should not be a barrier to exploring the human condition. We are surrounded by translation. It's invisible, and what's really interesting, that was very gratifying to me, is to see two epic novels for the 19th century win Academy Awards this year, Anna Karenina and Les Miserables. People love it. We've seen a translation of those books into stage musicals, into movies, and then across languages too. So people really get into romance and love. You can say, well, love stories have been written, you know, but there's always a need for it, right? So we love that. And again, the language should not be a barrier that they came from French or Russian. So what we'll be hearing from are seven authors, including Cam and Sylvia, who are here, who will talk about how great literature has influenced and inspired them, really shaped their writing. And when you think about a work in translation, there's really two levels to it. You've got the original that has all the music and flow of the prose, it has wordplay, that has metaphors, it has cultural references, it has dialogue, it has social registers. And then you have to have a translator who has to capture all that and make it accessible to a new audience. So there's actually a split in those two, kind of two books there. So the translator has to be as talented as the writer to capture all that and make it accessible. So these writers, who are gifted in and of themselves, will talk about kind of the layering of literature. In fact, Ann Packer, one of our guest authors, will be comparing two translations of Anna Karenina, a contemporary one and an older one, just to look at how the language has changed based on who the current audience is.
Right. Sounds pretty fascinating. And KM, at this event, at the Voices Carry event, you'll be reading from the late gay Cuban writer Ronaldo Arenas. And I'm wondering why you picked him and what do translations of his work from Spanish into English illustrate?
Thanks for asking. I'm thrilled to be able to talk about Ronaldo Arenas, who's such an important writer and one who has become more well-known over the last 10 years or so. He's the central figure in Before Night Falls, which is the name of his memoir. They made a movie of it with Javier Bardem playing the Arenas character. So a lot of people are aware of that book, although he wrote many books. He was raised in Cuba. He came out after the Cuban Revolution in the 1960s, and it was a very exciting time. He was a pro-Castro, pro-revolutionary writer. He himself grew up in poverty, and so the revolution represented a chance for social equality, distribution of wealth, all those things. And then it kind of got bad. And you see in Arenas' writing an absolute turning against the Castro regime, especially because they really cracked down on homosexuals. He himself was out. He went from being a Castro supporter to somebody who, as a writer, writing politically, writing about his sexuality, was seen as someone who needed to be silenced. So even though he was starting to find success as a writer, I think it was 1967, he was put in conflict with the communist government who eventually imprisoned him on the charge of ideological deviation, which was a sort of a combination of writing about explicit gay sex and gay relationships and also just not towing the sort of, at that point, quite Stalinist, you know, party line of the Castro regime.
So what do you have passages from it that you...
I'm not actually going to read from the autobiography. There's another long story novella of his called The Brightest Star. And I'm going to read two passages that are related to each other. They're brief. This is in the 60s in Havana. And the main character, Arturo, is a young gay man who goes with a bunch of other gay men to hear a classical music performance. I'll read now. The music began to fill the theater, and all of space and time was flooded with the sound and ennobled by it. The audience was mantled in a rare and wonderful spell. Their hands were brushed by warmth. They felt the music flow over through their bodies and lift them, and Arturo felt himself rising, being carried away to a place, another place, not this. The music softly cradled Arturo, picked him up, lifted him out of his seat, and gently, drawing back the draperies, set him down beside a tower in a flower bed in the afternoon next to the chinaberry tree and the blossoming dog rose bush in the breezeway. The music. Here in the middle of this rapt, gentle crowd, floating, listening, suddenly, out of nowhere, the tears began to flow, to roll down his cheeks, and he could feel that his face was bathed in tears. And he felt, too, he knew, that he couldn't stop them, that there was nothing he could do to keep them back. But he also felt, he knew, that he was almost happy. And then in the second passage, he and these gay friends of his leave the theater after this beautiful experience at the concert. As they came to the exit, there was a disturbance of some sort. There were shouts. Someone started running down the street. There was a shot. But only when it was already too late did Arturo and his friends realize that this was one of the more and more frequent roundups of young men being carried out these days under the absurd pretext that one young man's hair was too long or that another wore clothes of a certain cut or, most fatal, exhibited certain telling traits, had certain mannerisms. Arturo's friends were pulled in even before he was, and they gestured and gesticulated. They protested. They tried to get off, get out of it, get away, using the very voices and postures that had sentenced them beforehand in the other's eyes, the eyes of the police. But when they were led away or dragged to the machine gun guarded bus, Arturo didn't say a word. He was still hearing that unearthly melody, and it still had the power to transport him, lift him, and float him away.
Wow,
it's beautiful. The story is all written in that level of lyricism, and it gets more and more fantastical. You can get a sense of Arturo's imagination and the way he's affected by art. And so even though he gets taken to this essentially kind of concentration camp, they were called forced labor camps. A lot of gays were imprisoned there under Castro, and the story is set in that camp. And Arturo's only escape really is that he becomes a writer, and he writes out the kind of fantasies and artistic experiences.
It's a KM Soenlein reading from. Tell me the name of the story again.
The story is called The Brightest Star. It's translated by Andrew Hurley, who is a very esteemed translator of Spanish literature into English. He's the translator of Borges, among many others.
You know, as I was listening to that, I was thinking, like, wow, that is so beautiful. And yet I know it's not the original language, and it made me wonder, well, are sometimes do the translations come out more beautiful than the originals? Is that an effrontery to even say such a thing?
According to the authors, the original.
Well, things can be lost and gained in translation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It definitely goes both ways. Mm-hmm. And translators I've met in English say that they write because they love English. I mean, they're writers first, and they respect the source language. But it really is, it's a fun game. It's a challenge. You know, how do you make this accessible? There's an interesting case. Our Center for the Art of Translation did an event a few months ago with Mary Jo Bang, who translated Dante's Inferno last year from the Italian. And that's been translated dozens and dozens of times over 600 years. And she wanted to make it sound like it would have to an audience at that time, referencing contemporary figures, political, religious, you know, so-called media icons. So it's full of references to people like Woody Allen and Frank Lloyd Wright and the Beatles and Hotel California, and even characters from South Park make appearances in the third circle of hell.
Wow, okay.
And it's been very polarizing, but it's kind of a tribute to the Inferno, more than an accurate, fully accurate translation. But she definitely captures the spirit that a reader of the original would have had, knowing all those characters without lots of footnotes.
Because there were cultural references at that time when it was written.
Everybody knew.
Right. So KM, I want to go back to you for a minute. So Arrhenius was an out gay writer, politically outspoken. He died of AIDS, but he wasn't really out about his AIDS status at the time. Is that right?
As far as I know, it was a bit of a secret. He was very out and outspoken. When he finally got to the U.S., he came over in the Mariel boatlift, and he was very out and political about the situation, especially of gay men in Cuba. He was a fierce critic of Castro all the way up to the note he left behind after he killed himself when he was in the advanced stages of AIDS and felt that there was no hope for survival. He took an overdose of drugs, and he left behind a scathing note blaming Fidel Castro for his death. So he was very, very political and felt like it was sort of his job as an exile to speak the truth. I remember being in New York in the late 80s and being sort of aware of Arenas. Mm-hmm. The book I read from was given to me by an older friend who knew of his work. And that's where I was first introduced to him.
So is his story at all kind of, does it affect you in how you're writing your current novel? What's the status of Everybody? It's done? You're just looking for a publisher? I don't know how that works. You have to set it around and say, well, it's fine, but you got to change this. Then we'll publish it.
I finished the manuscript, and I'm actually looking for an agent to represent it and get it off to publisher. So any agents in your audience, find me through the website, I guess. Yeah.
And the website is kmsonline.com, right?
Oh, I was going to say your website.
Oh, my website. Well, you can get to our website. You know, we all need the traffic, outinthebay.org, sylviabrownrigg.com, catranslation.org, and Sonline, I got to spell that for people, SOEHNLEIN.
Very good.
KM Sonline. Well, I've typed it several times.
When you come back to the show more than once, they spell your name.
Your name right. And Brownrigg has two G's on the end.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. C-A translation. That's fairly obvious, I think. So I want to ask you both about the effect of winning a Lambda Literary Award. So, KM, for you, the World of Normal Boys, that was your first novel. And Sylvia, Pages for You was second novel?
It was my second novel. It was my third work of fiction.
Okay. So the other, meaning what?
Was I had a book of stories. My first book was a book of stories called 10 Women Who Shook the World.
Okay. So at any rate, fairly early in your careers, and I'm curious to know how the how winning an award from a national LGBT literary foundation affected your career or, your perception in the literary world.
It was such an honor to be nominated. I mean, the writers are always incredibly strong on the list. And when the irony for me of Pages for You's publication is that I was pregnant with my first child when the book was published, which, as many people will know, is a rather distracting state to be in. And then when the list of nominees came out, our son was about a year old. And so any, working parent knows that year, particularly the first year or two, you're very distracted, you're tired, logistics are complicated. But I went to New York for the prize-giving event with Sedge Thompson, who's my husband, and our son.
Sedge Thompson, by the way, is the host of West Coast Live on Saturday mornings on KLW. So Sylvia made the switch in the opposite direction that many of us did.
Right. So it was quite a funny thing to be at. I was at this event and with friends of mine, people I knew, and my joke was that Sedge was my beard, at the event. But it was a great evening. I think I'm recalling correctly that Margaret Cho hosted. She was a great MC. As I say, really strong writers. I was struck by looking at the nominees this year for the Lambda Award, because this was in 2002 that I got the award, that the categories keep multiplying. I mean, there were fewer. It's interesting about the LGBT world. I mean, there are many more different, it's all very multifaceted now, more than in...
With
even
the
more
National
than
Gay Journalists Association, same thing
oh,
happens there. There's many more categories than there were originally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it kind of makes you wonder, so I won this award. Does that mean, it's just, is it that imposter complex? Oh, I won from a gay organization, I wouldn't win it from, I don't know. I haven't got a Pulitzer Prize yet.
I won a Northern California Book Award, so that's also, it's sort of like,
regional.
They're all the little niche, they're in different niches.
Hey, I'll take any prize anyone
yes,
will give
right,
me.
Exactly.
I mean, it really does, to answer your question, to me, it makes a difference just in the sense that anytime somebody puts a seal of approval on your work, it catches someone's eye, you know, whether it's a reader who sees a little seal on the front of your book or something you put on your website, and that just gives you one little notch of, you know, approval from the world. I mean, it's tough getting the word out about any book.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I think for me, the winning the Lambda Award was not only a sort of a personal thrill and an acknowledgement and all that, but just you know, sort of put me in a place where people who care about that noticed and thought it meant something, you know, and for that I'm really super grateful.
And one last thing, it's getting close to the end of our half hour. Time flies. How does it affect you to have your novels translated into other languages? For you, German and French, is that right? And
yes, other novels. I mean, there have been Finnish and Spanish, but it was interesting when Brent was talking about how, you know, your books can lose and gain in translation. It was particularly with Pages for You, I think the translators got very involved in the translation process, so I had more detailed questions from the translators, and that it's very interesting to see which references turn out to be very culturally specific that you have to translate. You know, if somebody's doing a careful job of putting your work into their language, so I both those editions seem to find readers also, which is nice.
Cam?
I was really excited when my books were translated into Italian because I got to meet the translator. I went to Italy and I met this young man. His name is Matteo Colombo. And he was like younger than me, and he was super hip, and he had great taste in music. And I was like, oh, this cool young guy is translating my work. That's amazing. And a mutual friend who reads in both English and Italian said to me later, he said, you're lucky. You got a really good translation. This is a friend who can read both languages and so is aware, like, the difference between a translation that feels smooth and feels like a voice is being transmitted versus something that feels kind of clunky. So I think at least my Italian translations, I'm pretty confident, are okay.
Great,
yeah,
thanks.
I can't speak to the Finnish one.
Yeah, no idea, huh?
Looks good, though.
So K.M. Sohnlein and Sylvia Brownrigg will both be at the Voices Carry event on Saturday, April 20th at the City Club in San Francisco. Brent, where can folks get more information?
At catranslation.org. And let me mention that these two stellar authors will be joined also by Vikram Chandra, Yiyun Lee, Ayelet Waldman, and Anita Amirizvani, all of whom were born in different countries, in fact. And they'll all be reading from different languages that they may or may not even know. There's a great cross current. So catranslation.org. It's Saturday evening, April 20th at the City Club. Thank you, Eric.
And kmsohnlein.com and sylviabrownrigg.com if you want to find out more about their books. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Gay Radio from San Francisco. Thank you all so much for being here. If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org. It should be up by about 9 o'clock tonight, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher. That lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on the site. And now you can also hear about a dozen of our favorites from our past 8.5 years on the air, including interviews with John Waters, Ang Lee, Leslie Gore, Matthew Shepard's mother, Judy Shepard, and a feature on Liberace among them. Check it out, outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616. That's sfbar.org/LRIS. 415-989-1616. We've been producing Out in the Bay for more than 8 years, and we need your financial support. As an independent production, not a KALW staff production, Out in the Bay receives no funds from KALW. It's easy and tax-deductible on our website, outinthebay.org. There are also ways you can help us that do not involve your money. That's right. We could use your help and expertise in other ways. For example, research and production interns, computer help, affordable housing. It's, you know, I might lose my rent-controlled place soon, so it's always tough to survive in this world on an independent radio producer's. It's not even a salary. Out in the Bay. Go to our homepage to learn more, outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW, our host station, for studio use and airtime, and tonight's engineer, Joanne Marr. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. And now we're going out with our, rather than our usual theme music, the Black Box version of Everybody, Everybody, the name of K.M. Sohnlein's novel to be published any day now. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.